Welcome to this edition of Managing Through Crisis, where we feature Harvard Business School faculty sharing their insights on topics related to the world-changing pandemic that we find ourselves in the midst of. In previous episodes, we've covered a wide range of topics, from best practices for working remotely, to the role that leaders must play in times of crisis, to how small businesses can cope. Today, we're going to get personal, though, because our guest today is Arthur Brooks, and he's an expert on, of all things, happiness. Arthur has a joint appointment at both the Harvard Kennedy School and Harvard Business School. And before joining the Harvard faculty in July of 2019, he served for a decade as president of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a columnist for the Washington Post. He's also written 11 books, including the national bestseller, Love Your Enemies, which came out in 2019. Arthur, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you. Great to be with all of our viewers and listeners.
You know, I think we are sort of in week three in most parts of the country of the self-isolation drill that we're all going through. And
right.
The first couple of weeks, I think people have been really preoccupied with, like, how do I do the work from home thing? You know, how can I make sure I'm being productive? How can I continue to add value? And now, as things become more real and we're watching things unfold in the media that are really unsettling and troubling, I think we're starting to hit a different point of inflection with people. And I don't know if you're seeing the same thing. Is that one of your observations?
Yeah. So people can put up with almost any disruption to the schedule for a couple of weeks. You know, for a lot of the people in the HBS community, annual vacation is the disruption of work. I get that. We don't all have a diversified portfolio of life interests, and work is disproportionately interesting to a lot of people. And that's great as far as it goes. But once you get beyond 2 weeks of anything, it really starts to pinch, it starts to hurt. And so a lot of people are chafing against the lack of routine, their inability to be as productive as they'd like. They're starting to get a little stir crazy. Some are getting lonely. A lot of people are feeling really disappointed at the things that they're missing. And some, quite frankly, are feeling a strange sense of fear, notwithstanding the fact that they're not in particularly high risk groups for getting the virus. They're not likely to lose their income. They know their pensions are going to come back, but they have this weird specter of fear behind them that they're trying to understand. So I've been looking at all of those particular issues and how we can maybe make them better.
Yeah, I definitely want to come back to some of those things. But, you know, let's start, you know, your book, Love Your Enemies. I saw you give a talk on that at the business school earlier this year. It was really about the divide that, you know, exists in this country. And we all know that there's polarization and it's been highly politicized and it's been a pretty acrimonious environment for a long time now.
Right.
I'm just wondering, do you feel like a crisis like this has the potential to make that better, or will it drive us further away from each other?
Generally speaking, at the beginning of a crisis like this, people are really disappointed because we're not coming together. but as it drags on a little bit, it does tend to have a solidifying effect. I'm actually pretty hopeful that the polls in American political life today, which is to say the people in the 5%, and this is, you know, really according to the data, that our political discourse has been largely driven by the 5% fringes on sort of the so-called right or left. Whatever that means anymore, it's hard to say. But people who are in these 5% bunches, they're controlling a kind of an outrage industrial complex in America. A lot of the discourse in the media, what gets heard politically, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that will become less interesting as the sort of the 90% of us who are just, we really don't want to hate our neighbors, especially not for something as stupid and trivial as political differences. This, I think, it has a good and fighting chance of bringing into stark relief the trivialities we've been wrapping ourselves around and the really important things that we're seeing today.
I don't know if you might have seen the article that came out last week in Harvard Business Review. It's been pretty widely circulated by, it was an interview with David Kessler, where he talked about the emotion that you're feeling right now is grief.
Right.
And it struck a tone, it struck a nerve with a lot of people. I'm just wondering, do you think that's the right word?
Yes, grief, I think it catches, the reason that it got 3 million views or however it did is because it actually was what a lot of people were feeling at a time like this. But, you know, grief is a very complex set of cognitions. Grief comes from a kind of a mixture, an admixture of limbic emotional responses, things that we don't quite understand, but they it's a witch's brew of different feelings that all that come together. It is disappointment. It is fear. It is sadness. It is anger. All of which are highly limbic. You know, they come from around the amygdala. They fire very rapidly. They're sort of involuntary. When you put them all together, you get this thing that people, you know, they don't. It's intensely uncomfortable. And so when he said, yeah, this is, I'm grieving over something, it really struck people as being quite right. And I'm glad he wrote that piece, right? I'm glad that the piece was written with the interview and it got out there and made people and try to help understand themselves a little bit better.
Yeah, As I said, I think it struck a nerve with a lot of people. And I think another emotion that I've heard a lot of people talk about is uncertainty, and maybe those two things are linked together, or maybe fear and uncertainty. But just, you know, how would you suggest people deal with uncertainty in a time like this?
So uncertainty is, people have a tendency to use it synonymously with risk, and that's wrong. Risk is a phenomenon in which there's an outcome that is not known, but we understand what the possible outcomes are, and we can assign probabilities to different outcomes. The HBS community are experts in risk and how to manage risk. I mean, that's what we talk about in the classes. What we teach our students is how to manage risk. They're risk management experts. And one of the things that people find out is whether they should be entrepreneurial in their career or more in terms of conventional industries because of their capacity, willingness, and ability to take risk. Uncertainty is different. We don't know what the outcomes are. And so therefore, the probabilities of unknown outcomes are unknowable. That's a really different phenomenon. Now, why is uncertainty so intensely uncomfortable? The reason is because when you don't know what the outcomes are, they might be truly catastrophic, and we don't know what the probabilities are, you might truly be in danger. And that stimulates the amygdala to give you a fear response. Now, that fear response fires much, much faster than anything in your conscious brain. The human prefrontal cortex, you know, the part of our brains that makes us understand ourselves, you know, the conscious thoughts that we have, it's great, but it's slow. The amygdala will fire a fear response in 74 milliseconds, 74 one-thousandths of a second. And you're having this firing all day long. You know, you're looking at the news and you're feeling this intense uncertainty, which is giving you this fear response. Now, what we try to do naturally, especially HBS types like us, what we try to do is we try to take uncertainty and turn it into risk. How do you do that? By actually trying to understand the problem so that you can cognitively assign probabilities to outcomes. I can handle risk, can't handle uncertainty. So how do I do that? By binging on the internet all day long, by listening to news 7 hours a day. But here's the point. You can't turn it into risk. These are unknowable verities at this particular point. And so we're going about it in the wrong way. Number one, don't ignore uncertainty, because that'll just be like a ghost that's following you around. Don't try to turn the uncertainty into risk, because you can't do it. You don't have the computer simulations that the CDC has. Even they can't really do it very well. So how could we, if we're just watching CNN, do it? The way to deal with that uncertainty is to accept the uncertainty per se, to ration the amount of inputs that we're getting, and to do basically what psychologists tell cancer patients to do. You don't know what's gonna happen next week. You don't know. You don't know what's gonna happen next month, but you do know that you're alive today. That you do know. That is 100% certain. Bank on that, use that. And so what we need to do is to lean into the uncertainty per se and be fully alive today, as opposed to half alive and fully scared.
Yeah. One of the things, we've got a bunch of questions from our viewers, and I've sort of chunked them into, you know, personal questions. This is sort of like, how do I, as a person, deal with what I'm going through? And then there are things that are related to kind of job stuff, you know, like for my work, how do I deal with that? And then some questions for, if you're a manager, how can you help to move your team through a time like this? So you've just hit on one of the most important sort of personal questions that people have, which is, you know, how can I avoid fearing the worst in a situation like this? The other sort of flip side that to that is, how can I be optimistic? Is there an approach I can take to thinking about the silver lining in a situation like this?
So the key is not to try to be optimistic. Optimism says it's all going to be okay. I don't know if it's going to be okay. What we need to be is not optimistic. We need to be hopeful. Very different. Again, these are this often used synonymously, and it's incorrect to do so. Hope is to say something can be done and I can do it. Not that it's all going to turn out okay. So the key as a manager is to empower people to be hopeful and to be agents of something positive. Say, look, we don't know what's going to happen to our company. We don't know what's going to happen to the economy. We don't know what's going to happen to the coronavirus and who's going to get sick, but here's what we're going to do today to make something better. Here's how you are going to be the agent of something powerful and positive. This is what great leaders do. They say, do you see something better? Do you see your part in it? Let's get it done. You know, great, you know, terrible leaders, they say, I don't know. Great, you know, terrible leaders are paralyzed by uncertainty and fear per se, or even worse, because of uncertainty and fear, they display displacement behavior. They try to control things disproportionately to try to, it's very interesting, there's a lot of research that shows that when people who have a lot of fear of uncertainty, they tend to be prone to eating disorders. Why? Because they're transferring their uncertainty and their fear from uncertainty from one area into something they actually can control. Managers do that too. You know, managers will become despots and dictators over the things that they can control because they're afraid of the things that they can't. They have to resist that and simply to engender hope through empowerment and making people agents of positive change. That means different things in different environments. It means different things for different companies. But using our imagination, all of us can do that.
So we've heard from some folks who have said that they see their coworkers and people around them, you know, kind of moving from panic to, you know, fear, like a whole range of emotions. And they're asking, is there anything they can do to sort of calm people down and alleviate some of the panic that people are feeling?
The number one thing to remember is that fear for managers is a contagion, and it's contagious from the leader to the follower. It just is. I mean, it's extraordinary. One of the things that I talk about in my leadership classes that I teach at the Kennedy School is I say, your emotions matter disproportionately. It took me a long time as a CEO to figure this out, probably a couple of years. These are days when you're afraid or you're bummed out or you're angry or whatever. You have to calibrate your own emotions, understanding that there's an amplifying effect to your own emotions for the people who are looking to you for stability. So, and that's especially true in a time like this. You know, leaders need to be steady agents of, you know, what they need to reflect the environment that they want to see from the people in their workforce. This requires the greatest level of maturity. These are the times, these are the crucibles that separate great leaders from not great leaders. And a big part of it is the steadiness that they actually can show emotionally. If you're worried about too much panic and fear in your workforce, look yourself in the mirror. Are you showing fear and panic? That will be magnified by the people who are looking to you.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenges of working remotely. Everybody's got the technology. We're on Zoom. Zoom has turned out to be a lifesaver for a lot of folks.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Other platforms that people are using. So we've got interaction, you
right.
know. The feelings of isolation become real after
right.
after a period of time. Are there things that you can advise people on about how to feel like they still have that human contact that's so important?
So the main reason that people tend to suffer from isolation, the main neurochemical reason people suffer from isolation is because of the lack of a neurotransmitter that functions as a hormone. It's called oxytocin. Not to be obviously confused with OxyContin. Oxytocin is this neurotransmitter, and it's intensely pleasurable. It's produced by the human brain in response to eye contact and touch. It binds people to each other. It's an evolutionary phenomenon insofar as the greatest burst of oxytocin that your brain creates is the moment you lay eyes on your newborn child. This is what binds people to a complete stranger who can do nothing but lie there and cry and demand stuff. Like the minute you lay eyes on your newborn baby, you would die for that baby. It's like, why? What? Because it's oxytocin. It's a miracle and it's a gift. But we get it from looking at even strangers in the eye, but especially the people in our lives who are very meaningful to us. When we don't have touch, when we don't have eye contact, we don't get oxytocin. And that's where we get that intense loneliness and isolation that's really making people suffer. So the question really, therefore, is how to get your oxytocin that you're craving, even though you don't know you're craving it. And the answer, it all comes from, once again, from eye contact and touch. So the big mistake that people are making these days when they're really isolated is spending too much time on social media. Social media is beyond half an hour a day and unmitigated bad in people's lives under the best of circumstances. So what happens is if you use any social media for less than half an hour a day, it's a complement to your in-person relationships. Any more than half an hour a day, it starts becoming a substitute for your relationships. Now, what are you doing? You're getting a substitute for human relationships, so there's no eye contact and there's no touch. Bad. And so you're getting the empty, sort of empty social calories. 6 hours on Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook or you know, for people you're in my age, Twitter, which is, you know, what it's doing is it's basically, it's like eating burgers and fries for every meal. You're actually getting hungrier and you have less nutrition while you have too many calories at the same time. So start substituting the bad tech for the good tech. Brian, right now we're using good tech. Why? Because I'm looking at you, man. It's giving me pleasure. It's really great. I mean, we're talking about things that we care about, and I'm actually making eye contact right now. I can't touch you, but
it's social distancing.
Yeah, but I can look at you, and that's really important. So use tech where you can see. That's principle number one. Principle number two is eye contact with people with whom you're quarantining. You know, I have a tendency is kind of ships passing in the night. Of not making eye contact, not looking up from your book as you talk to people. You need to make eye contact with everybody. By the way, even people in the supermarket, just hi and make eye contact. That's weirdly pleasurable right now. That's because you got a little bit of oxytocin. The third is actually being purposive about making contact where people are touchable because you're quarantining with them. Everybody in your home needs to have a 20-second hug every 2 hours therapeutically. Because that's how oxytocin will peak, according to the best research on the matter.
That sounds like an assignment from you, Professor.
It's an assignment. It's from your social science professor at HBS. Says you got to go hug somebody for 20 seconds right now.
We've had some questions from folks about, you know, again, working from home, and how do you balance, you know, the work that you're doing? Everybody that I'm talking to, people who are on my team are saying, God, it's so intense. I feel like I'm working much more than I do when I'm at the office. And
right.
How do people think about alleviating the guilt, if you will, about like walking the dog around the block or doing something to step away from the intensity of the work?
So what's happened is that people have stepped back from the exoskeleton of work that's imposed by an outside schedule. And what they've substituted for is the endoskeleton of work where you set up your own schedule from home. Now, that's good as far as it goes, right? I mean, there's all kinds of good things that come from that. You know, people, students in particular, they're very used to the exoskeleton, so they feel at loose ends when they don't have it. Learning how to be internally disciplined, how to create focus for yourself, your own skeleton of your work is great. The problem is no more boundaries. You know, your home is now your office. And furthermore, you know, there's a lot of things that we generally do that tend to be really unproductive. For example, your brain can't, as a cognitive matter, your brain can't distinguish between checking emails for fun and checking emails for work. You know, scrolling through Facebook might be something you do when you have when you're wasting time or when you're waiting in line at the airport, but that's work as far as your brain is concerned. And those are wasted cycles. This is especially pronounced when we're all working from home. People are feeling more and more and more desperate because they're effectively working 18-hour days. You know, it doesn't mean they're productive because they're wasting most of their cycles on stupid stuff. And it's the same thing as the burger and fries phenomenon. I'm working 18-hour days, but I'm only getting 5 hours of work done. That's extremely uncomfortable. So what we need to do is to internally impose a structure around it and schedule everything, not just work. You need to schedule dog walking time. You need to schedule your hugging time. You need to schedule your supper. You need to schedule your television watching. Put it in the schedule. I mean, given the fact that you can't distinguish between work and life, you need to schedule your life as well as just your work and make sure you're not working more than about 10 hours a day, because more than that, it's a waste of your time and you'll be unhappy.
That's great advice. I've got two more questions for you if you can stick around for another minute.
Of course.
One is about goals. You know, most of us are required as part of our work to submit our goals for the coming year or for the coming 3 years right. or in the next month, whatever it might be. Some people are struggling with that notion of how do I even think about like next week? You know, how should people grapple with that kind of issue?
I am not a big fan of goals to begin with. I think goals are a tyranny. And what I believe that we should have more of is intentions. Intentionality is highly directional. Goals tend to be highly, to turn into a form of attachment very quickly. They become extremely dogmatic. They become tyrants over us. And that's especially true right now, where, you know, we're so used to being goal focused in our work, and now we're trying to actually recreate or reimagine what our work is. And so we set up these goals, and they're, you know, they're basically cracking the whip on us, and it's not fun and it's not good. We need to basically have the projects that we're working on for all kinds of good reasons. You know, these are things that need to get done and these things that I want to do, and be intentional about going in a particular direction without being attached to the particular outcome. Now, I think that that's actually a good way of thinking about it at work in general, that we should be more intentional and less goal focused. And what we call that is an intention without attachment. It's a very Buddhist concept, of course, but it's good for all of us, whether we're Buddhists or not, is to be more intentional and less attached.
Okay, last question for you.
Yeah.
When you wake up tomorrow morning,
yeah,
how do you start your day? What's the thing that you think about to get you emotionally ready for what's coming?
I start my day thinking about what I'm grateful for. And there's a lot that I'm grateful for. I mean, I'm waking up in my house with my wife and daughter. I have grown-up children, and they're safe and well. And I go through a list of things that I'm really grateful for. And the next thing that I do is I exercise for an hour first thing every morning. And one of the things that you have to do is to take care of your body when you're isolated like this. And I have a very complicated routine that I've been doing for the past 25 years, and it hasn't stopped. It just means that I have to do it in my house instead of at the gym. The third thing is I do my prayer, which is real important to me. It gets me ready for the day, but it helps me remember what's truly important in my life. You know, the happiest people, they have a portfolio of happiness, and that has to do with their faith or life philosophy, whether it's secular or religious. It has to do with their family, it has to do with their friendships, and then it has to do with their work that serves others in which they can earn their success. This is a robust finding across all of social science. But so starting with things that really matter that could get shoved out of the way, and then I hit my schedule and I march through it. And when I'm finished at 7 o'clock in the afternoon, so I, you know, from 8 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock in the afternoon, I work. And I just said, I told everybody not to work more than 10 hours, and I just said 11. So I realized that, you know, it's a physician, heal thyself. But at 7 o'clock, I stop, and we have supper, and, you know, we do our evening routine, and it's working for me pretty well, I have to say. I can't imagine doing this for another 6 months, but so far so good.
Arthur, it's made me happy just talking to you today.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it a lot. You know, you're sitting in front of Baker Library, and it's you know,
beautiful here.
It is beautiful, and my office is on the third floor of Baker Library, and I miss it. I love HBS so much. I'm so happy and so grateful to be part of the community. The students are fantastic. My colleagues are great. It's important for all of us to remember, who are part of this community, that the community stays strong. HBS is doing important work in just a few weeks. We're not talking about years. We're probably not even talking about months. We're going to be back at that work. What can we do as a community to be a beacon of light and hope for the rest of the world, to be leaders in a way that really matters morally, ethically, emotionally, raising people's happiness? I think we can. I think we can come out of this maybe better than we went in. And I'm grateful to HBS to help make that possible.
Thanks, Arthur.
Thanks, Brian.